You're listening to a sermon by Claire Goodfellow, recorded on Sunday, August 16th, 2026, at Point Grey Interminite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
As a pedestrian, I have had several occasions where I have felt dangerously invisible. In particular, with drivers who are in a big hurry to get through the already completed left turn advance light. I know I'm not alone in such encounters. Truthfully, we're not always aware of what is around us. There are other situations where one can be left experiencing a sense of being overlooked, lost in the crowd, forgotten, taken for granted. It's all very easy to do. However, when we look at Psalm 139, for example, we're reminded that God not only sees us, but recognizes and knows us. For example, from verses 1 to 5. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in from behind and before, and lay your hand upon me. Today, I would like to look at some examples of being seen and validated in scriptures. There are lots of them, but I will only look at three. In Luke 13, verses 10 to 13, we meet one of these, a woman bent over in the spirit of infirmity, as verse 11 notes. Here she is at the synagogue with her neighbors, perhaps some family and friends, a regular crowded Sabbath day, the standing and the sitting and the moving about. Everyone is used to seeing her and not seeing her as she is bent over. After a while, it's possible that most really don't see her. She can get lost in the crowd. Her physical deformity becomes common acceptance, no longer seems odd or out of place. It's normal. This is how she's been for the past 18 years. And maybe she is a little invisible. There are various discussions on what the woman was actually suffering from. One writer suggests that it was curvature of the spine or an arthritic inflammation of the vertebrae, both which will develop into a distorted spine and include the inability to stand up straight. Regardless of the reason, Jesus sees her in the crowd, and she isn't in a position to be easily seen either. However, he singles her out from everyone else, speaks to her directly, then lays his hands on her and tells her, "You are loosed from your infirmity." And with Jesus' command, she stands up straight for the first time in 18 years and praises God for his healing. As Dr. Sandra Glahn in her piece, The Bent Over Woman Whom Jesus Healed, noted, and I quote, "She's vertical for the first time in nearly two decades. Instead of seeing people's shoes, she sees their faces with joy and at her full height, an unexpected release," unquote. She was seen and known, healed and validated, and hence changed, not lost, forgotten, nor invisible anymore. Psalm 139, verses 7 to 10. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand will lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. Then in Luke 19, verses 1 to 10, we meet Zacchaeus, a man of a certain not so good of a reputation in Jericho. Chief tax collectors were owned by the Roman state and had a profound reputation for acquiring for themselves and through many different means, which were allowed or not, additional wealth. Hence, they were very much distrusted and disliked. And Zacchaeus was well aware of this. So, when the news that Jesus was passing through Jericho on this day, Zacchaeus thought he might like to join the crowd and just see this Jesus as he walked through the city. A wee glimpse, you know, get out of the office, grab a coffee, and join the crowd. Take a break, so to speak. Another problem in this situation was that Zacchaeus was short, which meant that probably he would need to be in the front row to be able to see Jesus. And given his particular reputation, no one would be willing to make room for him in the crowds along the pathway so he could get to the front row. Competing with children, not a good image. Undeterred, and I would also suggest creative, Zacchaeus found a sycamore tree to climb and hide up in the foliage. Sycamore trees apparently were very easy to climb. They have lots of branches that spread out horizontally and have lots of foliage as well. Zacchaeus would have had a good place to perch there and at the same time be hidden from above the crowds below. Now he was probably quite chuffed when he got up there. He had a great view. He didn't have to push and shove to have a clear advantage. No children poking him or no one heckling him. He was almost invisible. And perhaps he liked it that way. So he probably settled down in his perch in the sycamore tree and waited. But, and we knew there was a but coming. As Jesus passed by, he did see Zacchaeus up hidden in the tree. And yes, Jesus knew him. He called him out by his name and invited himself to Zacchaeus's house for a visit. Now, that's a bit of a shocker. You can imagine the consternation of the gathered crowds. It's Jesus' choice of selecting Zacchaeus. And why him? And to top it all off, Jesus actually headed home with Zacchaeus to this totally disliked, disrespected tax collector's home. But it was with great elation for Zacchaeus, and not with astonishment, but with joy. And Zacchaeus, moved by this acknowledgement of Jesus, repented, not in words, but in deeds. He pronounced his desire to make restitution for the selfishness and the greed that had consumed his life, telling Jesus he would restore all that he had taken illegally, four times the amount, and then his willingness to give half of his goods to the poor. And can you imagine again the reaction of his fellow citizens? Zacchaeus was seen and known and validated and changed after his meeting with Jesus. Psalm 139, verses 11 to 14. I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night. Even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. For you formed my inward parts, you knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. However, it is the story of Hagar from Genesis 16 and 21 that lingered with me for some time. Hagar doesn't seem like the heroine of the story, for she is someone caught in the middle of other people's desperate dilemma. Hagar is an Egyptian woman. As a woman, she has few options in life. She can be a slave, or a concubine, or a wife. Here she starts out as a slave. Sarah and Abram, in their attempt to begin the great nation promised to them by God, feel the need to hurry the process along given their age. Use Hagar as a concubine. They all agreed. However, problems arose for Sarah, who becomes jealous and cognizant of the shift in the power relationship between the pregnant Hagar and herself. Uncomfortable, to say the least. As a result, Sarah, in her anger, physically mistreats Hagar, Genesis 16, verse 6. And because of this abuse, Hagar runs away, out into the wilderness, alone. But God finds Hagar and asks her, "Where are you from and where are you going?" And in the process of their conversation, makes a promise to her about her unborn son in verse 10 to 12, then tells her to return. Hagar's response is most profound. "You are El-Ra, the God who sees," and concludes with, "Surely this is a place where I, in my turn, have seen the one who sees me." Richard Rohr, the Franciscan priest, in his reflections on Hagar, sees her as the only one to give God a name. Here, God is not, and I quote, "a distant entity from one who sees, hears, and provides for her," unquote. In addition, Rohr has commented on Hagar as a symbol of those who are seen as oppressed, foreigners, slaves, and women who have been abused or mistreated, unquote. In Genesis 21, years later, Sarah, who is 90, finally conceives and Isaac is born. Problems arise again, and when Sarah sees Ishmael, who's about 13 to 15 years of age at this point, playing with her little son Isaac at the weaning feast, she is angered again. And it's clear that Sarah does not want the two boys to be sharing the inheritance promised to Abram. Hagar and Ishmael were sent away, gone with both the knowledge and permission of Abram, albeit distressed, after the command of God, who has promised Abram that Hagar's son will also belong to a great nation. They were sent away with a skin of water and bread, and they head out into the wilderness of Beersheba. When the water runs out, Hagar is filled with despair and goes and sits apart from her weeping child. Her mother's anguish at seeing her son in great distress causes her immense pain. And again, God calls to her, "Don't be afraid, Hagar," and promises her a future for her son. God opens her eyes and she sees a well from which they are nourished. Eventually, they make their home in the wilderness of Paran, and in time, Ishmael marries an Egyptian wife, and God was with the boy, Genesis 21, 20. As Grace Fox notes, "The God who sees me," the English translation of a Hebrew name, El-Ra, suggests more than physical sight. It also implies understanding and care. We might say that God sees us with the eyes of his heart, unquote. Psalm 139, verses 15 to 18. "My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as of yet there was none of them. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God! How vast is the sum of them! If I were to count them, they are more than the sand. I awake and I am still with you." Kirk Panetta wrote the following, and again, I'm going to quote because sometimes it's best just to quote. "Throughout the ages, the need to feel seen has been a crucial part of being human. While it might sound simple, being seen entails a cascade of other acknowledgments, such as trust, acceptance, understanding, love, respect, and belonging. Feeling seen is a state in which a part or parts of our identity, our emotions, needs, and/or physical presence gets fully recognized through various means such as representation, validation, support, and/or inclusion. The opposite of feeling seen often leaves us feeling invisible, unheard, and neglected. In the Kazakh culture, friendship or love between humans bloom from being seen. So, I like you in Kazakh means I see you clearly. It is comforting that God sees and knows his children imperfect and often lost and bewildered by life situations, whether in the temples, on the streets, or in the wilderness of our own lives. So when I cross the street, I continue to make certain drivers know that I see them and I am watching them. I've developed the neck of an owl until I am safely out of their reach. But most of all, I'm keenly aware that God sees me and I am under his protection, for which I am grateful. So may the Lord bless you and keep you, and may his face shine upon you and grant you his peace wherever he finds you.